So let me stand here, otherwise I can't see what I'm going to talk about. So this is work that I have done essentially over the years with various collaborators. We started working on this about 1998 with Steve Kivelson and Vic Emery, who passed away a few years later. And then, as you can see, we have done a number of things over the years. There are several, for those of you who may be interested in the subject, there are several reviews we have written. There was a review of modern physics back in 2003. And more recently, I wrote a set of lectures based on some lectures that I gave in Les Rouges almost 2 years ago. And these are fairly up to date, except that the field keeps moving, particularly the experimentalists keep changing things and making it more interesting. So it was up to date then, and it's not fully up to date now, since there are more things to discuss. Concerning a subject that actually is very much of current interest, which is the role of so-called nematic phases, we wrote a review recently with all these people here, and so you may be interested in looking at that. What I will talk about today is about the particular type of phase that appears in this framework that I will discuss today, that we call the pair density wave phase, that embodies many of these ideas, and I will focus on that because it's a phase that occurs in a system where charge order is documented experimentally to occur as static order, and so it's of particular interest to understand the type of static order that is actually seen. Okay. So this is actually was based on some work. This paper was supposed to be a review, but halfway through the paper we realized we knew more things, so half of the paper is not a review, and then there are more things that I will talk at the end. So let me tell you what electronic liquid crystal phases are, and in particular I'm going to focus on doped MOT insulators. As you know, a MOT insulator is a system that band structure people tell us should be a nice conductor, and it isn't. Okay, so it's usually driven by correlation effects, whether they are strong, medium, or weak, depends on your opinion on things, but these are certainly systems that don't occur in states that don't occur in the free electron picture. And in that regime, typically there are correlations that characterize these MOT insulators. So for instance, in the case of a system like, say, Hubbard model, which is sort of a simple system that exhibits some of these physics, usually you end up, we have some antiferromagnet that have filling, and when you dope this antiferromagnet, you disrupt the correlations that were embodied in this MOT insulating state. That disruption leads to an effective attraction between the doped holes in that case, because the holes that are together are happier than if they were far apart, since they disrupt the native correlations less. So there is an effective attractive interaction that appears in a system which nominally only has repulsive interactions. In addition to that, you may actually have strong repulsive interactions. If you dope an insulator, you have to be careful that you cannot neglect the Coulomb interaction. It's always there. And the Hubbard model, of course, neglects that, reduces that to a non-site interaction. But if you are in the insulating state, this is a bit problematic. So you have a system where both kinetic energy and longer range repulsive interactions tend to spread the charge apart. And this effect that I described before tends to have a charge cluster. Originally, when back in the early days of ITC, when people were doing numerical calculations and simulations in small systems, this effect was confused with pairing, because if you have two charges that are happier if they are together, they will say, well, that looks like pairing, but if you put a third charge, it's also happy, and the fourth charge is also happy, so that's called phase separation in reality. So there is a strong tendency in systems of this type to form inhomogeneous phases, at least locally, because of the nature of the strong correlated nature of the system, essentially. So what we essentially set out to do was to figure out what kind of ground state systems with this type of physics may actually have, and it turns out that concepts that actually were born originally in the in classical statistical physics, particularly in the context of liquid crystal states, will be actually quite useful to describe this state. Okay, so this is what I just described. So the states that result in the absence of disorder, I will discuss first what happens with no disorder. Disorder is very important for all these states. They typically break many symmetries of the lattice. So they usually they break translation symmetry, and so these things are usually called stripes. If they break translation symmetry completely, they usually are crystalline states. They, in some sense, they are relatives of the good old Wigner crystal in that limit. And there are some phases, of course, if the system is doped sufficiently, they eventually will become homogeneous, and then it could become a nice Fermi liquid, presumably. And halfway between that, you could have phases that have both liquid and crystalline states, and examples of that are nematic states that have become popular recently. So those are states that break translation symmetry to various degrees and rotation symmetry, if you wish, the point group symmetry of the lattice in that case. So in lattice systems, which are most of the cases we're interested in, these symmetries are actually discrete, and we have to keep that in mind. Particularly the rotation symmetries are discrete. So what are the examples? The stripe phases of high temperature superconductors are examples of this, and I will discuss a particular one today. The so-called nematic phase of the two-dimensional electron gas in large magnetic fields is another example of a state of this type. Back in high TC, in YBCO and in BISCO, and more recently in the nictides and in heavy fermions, nematic states have been observed experimentally. So what is interesting in this particular case is that in addition to the charge and spin orders that these phases may exhibit, they're also superconducting. So you need to figure out what is the relationship between these different types of orders. So I'd like to think of this as how liquid crystals got an H-bar, or as a form of soft quantum matter, or quantum soft matter, depending on what your politics is. You use one order of the terms or the other, okay? But it's a nice example about the unity of physics, in the sense that very often people think of these problems as if they were completely different. One is a classical problem, the other is a quantum problem. You think about the Hubbard model, I think about, you know, some soft, fuzzy stuff. And in this particular case, you see that you need to think about both. And this actually is dictated, in my opinion, by experiment. So let me tell you about, in the context of high TC, what do we know about these states. So the stripes are charged order states with unidirectional order. So in a sense, they are, from the point of view of their order parameters, they are indistinguishable from a charge density wave, in the sense that they have the same order parameter. If I use the term charge density wave, you will think of a partially gapped Fermi surface or something like that, and it's unclear if that description is applicable to the high TC materials. In my opinion, it isn't. And for that reason, I will use a different term. So in some sense, it's a strong coupling version of a charge density wave. A nematic state is a state that is uniform, and as such, since it's actually a conducting system, it's a metal or a superconductor, but it has anisotropic transport properties. So it breaks the point group symmetry, but it's uniform aside from that. So let me tell you about this. So the stripe and pneumatic order states in high TC are seen, for instance, in lanthanum barium copper oxide and in the neodymium doped LSCO, which I think there will be a talk about that today, on that, near the so-called magical doping of 1/8, which is where charge order is seen as static order. So static stripes in LSCO and YBCO are also seen if you apply magnetic fields. In LSCO, you only need to apply relatively weak fields. In YBCO, it depends on the doping range. If they are very underdoped, you don't need to apply much of a magnetic field to see static stripes. If it is not too underdoped, then you need to have fairly strong fields to see this effect. And this has been seen in elastic neutron scattering, INS from now on, and in quantum oscillation experiments as well. At least this is an interpretation of the quantum oscillation experiments. There are others. Okay. Now, nematic order in the pseudo-gap regime of YBCO has seen now in various probes inelastic neutron scattering for 6.45, so this is fairly underdoped material. There is no spin gap at this regime, in this regime now. So they see essentially an enhancement of, you may call it an enhancement of orthorhombicity, but it has a very strong temperature dependence and a sharp, a relatively sharp onset at about 150 degrees Kelvin. So they see the system becoming much more anisotropic for purely electronic reasons, in a sense. And so it has been correctly identified as an ematic state. And similarly, this is seen in transport experiments, particularly in the NERNS measurements by the Sherbrooke group. Okay. So the current understanding is at least a good chunk of what we normally call the pseudo-gap regime appears to have this type of character. And this is seen, as I mentioned before, in things like the nictites. In particular, there's one family where this actually this type of physics has been seen. In the bilayer ruthenates in magnetic fields, this is actually a very nice experiment by the McKenzie group where they see the same effect. And more recently, in this rather famous heavy fermion superconductor, well, heavy fermion material that in the so-called hidden order phase appears to have also broken point group symmetry. So in that sense, it's another candidate for an ematic state. This is uranium, ruthenium 2, silicon 2. And as I said, in the two-dimensional electron gas in large magnetic fields, this is the system where the effect is seen most pronouncedly. Aside from that, charge ordering is usually seen as, quote, fluctuating stripes, which is a term I don't like, even though I wrote the paper about that. This is like being half pregnant. Okay, so what do people mean by fluctuating stripes? Even there is order or there isn't, right? What they mean is that there are fluctuations that are reminiscent of a charge order state that are dynamical and they have very low energy character. In particular, the energy scale is very low compared to the superconducting gap. So, for example, in YBCO and in particular in LSCO, what is seen in the superconducting phases is that they see this type of, quote, fluctuating order in the scale of a few millivolts, where the gap is typically of the order of 40 millivolts. So one interpretation is one is slightly on the wrong side of the phase diagram, that the system, with some help, may actually condense into a charge order state, and the material doesn't quite have it, but the gap is very small. Okay. And for that reason, states of this type are better characterized as being ematic states. So you can think of an ematic in two different ways. One way to think of an ematic state is essentially a nice Fermi liquid, if you wish, where the point group symmetry somehow broke spontaneously, say through a Pomeranchuk instability where the Fermi surface spontaneously distorts. If you take that viewpoint, you will never see this type of behavior. On the other hand, if you begin with a stripe state and you melt the stripe state either thermally or quantum mechanically, then you will see an isotropy, but you will see low energy fluctuations that are reminiscent of the nearby order phase. And essentially the phenomenology of most of the systems is actually a lot closer to that picture than to the simple picture of a spontaneously distorted Fermi surface, which doesn't have these correlations alone. Okay. So on the other hand, disorder in this type of systems is actually extremely important, since it couples linearly to the order parameter of all of these phases, both in translation symmetry and rotation symmetry. It acts as a random field, effectively. And therefore, on very long length scales, these phases should not occur at any finite disorder because the materials are actually quasi-two-dimensional. So what we see, for the most part, is some form of local order, and the clean materials in the very best UBC-vetted materials, what happens is that the disorder is sufficiently correlated so that the materials are seen as being clean, and therefore the patches are very long, are very big in that particular case. So the patches where this type of order is seen, then it's actually most clear there than the system which is almost homogeneously disordered. And so for that reason, it's much harder to see it in a material like LSCO. LBCO is special, and I will discuss that in a moment, why LBCO is special and why it helps to think about that. But in BISCO, which is not the cleanest material, but is the one that clears best, as we will hear this afternoon, they do see local pneumatic order over fairly long landscales. And this is these are the STM experiments in Seamus Davis's group, and Seamus will discuss this at some length today. I hope. I think that's what he will talk about. So, but the real question here is, so what? So are these states friends or foe of superconductivity? Are these part of the mechanism or a problem to the mechanism? So there are two, as you know, this is a worse than religion. There are many churches and sects in this field, and I believe to the church that believes that if the first thing you encounter is this, it has to have some relationship with the superconducting state. But for that to be true, some hints of superconductivity has to be present in this order. If all you have is just charge order, so for instance, if all you have is pneumatic order, all you're doing is making this direction different than that direction. So if I stretch one direction and shrink the other direction, why should the system care from the superconductivity point of view? So it's actually a big challenge to understand what is the connection, particularly between the pneumatic state and superconductivity. That's an open problem. I will show you today that there is a variant of the charge order state that actually is naturally equipped with superconducting fluctuations. And therefore, in that sense, it actually gives us hints in a strongly coupled system how all these three types of order actually come together. Of course, it will take a fair amount of doping, nearly optimal, I would say, to get to the point where the superconductivity becomes homogeneous, which is what most experimentalists like to see. Okay? So let me discuss the particular case of LBCO and why this case is interesting. Okay? So this is, first of all, this is the original high-temperature superconductor. This is where HIBC was discovered in the first place. It's not the best material, and for that reason it was abandoned, not only because TC is not as high as in the other materials, it has a peculiar anomaly, which is where the charge order exists, and we'll discuss that in some detail. Okay, so it's known to exhibit low energy stripe fluctuations in the superconducting state in much of the phase diagram that I will show you. However, near 1/8 doping, TC drops down precipitously. You will see that the typical value of TC is of the order of 40 Kelvin, and when you get to 1/8, it drops down to something like 4 Kelvin. And so you would say, when you see that, you say, well, that's a clear proof that charge order is bad for superconductivity since TC goes down like crazy. However, nature is more interesting than that, as you will see. So it has, and this actually happens in a particular crystal structure called the LTT, or for low temperature tetragonal crystal structure, that begins at about 54 or 52 Kelvin. So the experimental evidence that I will want to discuss here from the Brookhaven group is the existence of a very peculiar effect that we like to call this a superconducting layer decoupling near 1/8. In other words, the system behaves as a quasi-two-dimensional superconductor for temperatures which are well above the nominal TC of the material and becomes a three-dimensional superconductor at that TC. So let me show you that data in a moment. And it's actually the clearest example of the interconnection between all these three types of orders that we want to discuss today. So I want to interpret the layer decoupling that I will explain in a moment simultaneous with the presence of long-range charge and spin order and superconductivity as an indication of a novel type of striped superconducting state that I would like to call a pair density wave, even though this name was used before for something else, in which charge, spin, and superconducting orders are intertwined. So rather than competing orders, in this case, they come together. So it's a little different than the concept of competing order. A pair density wave here, I don't mean by a density wave of pairs. It's not the same thing. So this actually will be, as you will see in a moment, what I have in mind is a paired state with a finite momentum. Okay? And that's different than a charge density wave of pairs, which in some senses is indistinguishable from a conventional charge density wave. So this is the experimental phase diagram from lanthanum barium copper oxide. you see the two superconducting domes. Cirrus has two of them instead of one. And optimal doping is about here. And you see that the typical value of TC is around somewhere around 40 Kelvin or something like that. It drops down to about 4, which is here, precisely at 1/8. Okay? But on the other hand, there is a lot of stuff that is happening here. First of all, there is a structural transition between a high temperature for us. It's called a low temperature orthorhombic because it's low compared to ambient temperature. From an orthorhombic phase to a so-called tetragonal phase, which isn't quite tetragonal. It's a phase, as you will see, where the planes essentially are orthorhombic, but the orthorhombicity rotates from plane to plane. So the overall crystal structure is orthorhombic, but each plane individually isn't. So that happens at about 52 Kelvin or something like that. And then various other phase transitions and orders occur as you lower the temperature and you come down towards this point. Okay? So this data is from Marcus Hooker and collaborators in Brookhaven. And this has also been now confirmed in various other ways. So for instance, you can take the 1/8 dope material and apply hydrostatic pressure, and you can see phase transitions. For instance, you can see the disappearance of the LTT phase into a true tetragonal phase and the charge order phase remaining present in that phase. So let me show you the interesting transport data from the Brookhaven group. This is a little old now. It's almost 4 years old. And first of all, there was some earlier work first done in Brookhaven and then at Stanford, well, actually, I guess at Berkeley, these ARPES data. So what they see in ARPES in this material is that as you go around 1/8, the antinodal gap is essentially insensitive to that. So in other words, if you interpret the antinodal gap as a measure of the superconducting gap or something like that, then basically doesn't, even though TC drops down precipitously at that point, the antinodal gap seems to be essentially insensitive. The only difference between the two groups was that the Brookhaven group claimed that the antinodal gap was actually largest at that point, and the Stanford group says that it's not suppressed, or if anything, it's slightly rising as you underdog. The Stanford group has presumably better, well, my impression is that it has better resolution, so it's probably more trustable in that sense. But the moral here is not, even though there are slight differences in the data between the two groups, neither of these groups see a suppression of the antinodal gap at that point. So at 54 Kelvin, you have this structural transition. This particular material that coincides with the onset of charge order, which is not the case, for instance, in European dope LSCO, which has similar physics. There they are separate. Static spin order, which looks like what usually is called a spin stripe, appears at 42 Kelvin, which is at the lower temperature. So you first see charge order, then you see, then you see spin stripes. As immediately below this point, I will show you the data now, the in-plane resistivity drops very rapidly to zero from essentially 42 Kelvin down to a temperature which is of the order of 18 or 20 degrees that experimentally is characterized as a Costa-Lizaudis transition. It looks like essentially like a two-dimensional superconductor. And you see KT-like behavior over a fairly broad range that goes from 42 to 20. In between all of this, the C-axis resistivity continues to rise and begins to drop at about 30 Kelvin or so, but only goes to zero, so there is a resistive transition in the C-axis at about 10 Kelvin. And you don't see a full Meissner state until 4 Kelvin. And if you look at the ratio of the in-plane resistivity to the C-axis resistivity, essentially it's larger than 5 orders of magnitude over a broad range of temperatures. So that's a very peculiar behavior. Whatever your opinion of the origin of superconductivity, it's clear that the planes are much more conducting than the C-axis data implies. And there is a lot of physics that is going on above 4 or 10 Kelvin. So it's also the fact that the resisted transition doesn't coincide with the Meissner state is also peculiar in this case. In most of the other materials, they are usually fairly close to each other. In fact, most of the time, this is how essentially TC is determined in transport. So here is essentially the summary of that. And what we want to propose is that in this range, above essentially 4 Kelvin, there is some sort of striped superconductivity that is taking place in the planes. And I will try to explain why this actually helps explain this data. So here's the data. This is the transport data. They have more data, but I will just be happy to show you this. So this is the ratio of rho C over rho AB, and this is the AB plane resistivity as a function of temperature and magnetic field. So if you look at the second panel here, you see that at the structural transition, which is here, there is a slight glitch in that, but aside from that, it remains effectively constant. And then as soon as you get into the so-called spin transition, then it begins to drop. At about 35 Kelvin, it changes character, and then it comes to zero at about 18 Kelvin or so. Meanwhile, if you look in the same temperature range, you can see here in the inset, rho C is actually doing something quite different. It peaks at about 35, which is about here, begins to drop, but it's only zero essentially at a much lower temperature. You can see that actually more clearly here. So this is the place where rho AB vanishes. And this is where the resisted transition happens. They are clearly different. On the other hand, if you look at the in-plane IEV curves, you can, well, over the range that the experiment could be done, essentially it can be represented by a KT scaling form. Now, the data is not of the quality that people that do two-dimensional or do thin films will be happy with. So they don't have the dynamical range, if you wish, that is seen in, typically in thin films, but it's certainly consistent with that type of behavior. So how do we understand this rather remarkable set of effects? Okay. So we seem to see superconductivity in the planes, but not in three dimensions. That already is rather strange. So there is this broad temperature range where you see 2D superconductivity, but not in 3D, as if there was no Josephson coupling between the layers. Now, that's rather odd. You normally think that you are not free to tune the Josephson coupling to zero. And as soon as the superconducting fluctuations become sufficiently long-ranged, then the C-axis Josephson effect should kick in, and the system should become a three-dimensional superconductor. That's the correct physics that one should expect, okay? At the same time, we see both striped ordering charge and spin. And what we want to propose is that there is a special symmetry of the superconducting state in this striped order system that actually makes all of this possible. So let me show you a picture of some sort of texture state. So let's discuss what the symmetry of the system is. First of all, it's an LTT crystal structure that has two planes in the unit cell to begin with, because of the rotation. The stripes in the second neighbor planes are shifted by half a period, if there is stripe order, due to the Coulomb interaction. So you expect the actual number of planes in the unit cell to be 4 and not 2, because if you have one plane, one stripe here and the next one there, the next one cannot be parallel to that, it has to be shifted, and so on, in order to minimize the Coulomb energy. So you'd expect that the period is actually 4, and that's actually quite a big distance. It's much bigger than the in-plane unit cell. The antiferromagnetic order is known to suffer a pi phase shift across the charge order stripe, which has period 4 approximately in that case. And what we propose is that the superconducting order is also striped and also suffers a pi phase shift. In other words, instead of a uniform superconductor, it's an oscillating superconducting state. So the superconductivity in this picture resides in the spin gap regions, and there is a pi phase shift in the superconducting order across the antiferromagnetic regions. So here is a cartoon of that. So think of this as a D-wave superconductor that you have here. and the strength is different, so there's a change in the sign of the pairing of the pairing amplitude, but the strength is different because the material is anisotropic. But as you go from this stripe to the other, to the next one, there is a rotation, there is a pi phase shift, which is to say the A and B it is as if the A and B directions were to rotate relative to each other. Or if you wish, the lobes of the D-wave superconductor rotate from each other as you cross the stripe. So this actually leads to a superconducting state that is oscillatory and change the sign. And as you can see, has all three orders in it. Okay? So this tape, a state of this type was found in variation of Monte Carlo by various groups, particularly by Ogata in 2004. And they were looking at TJ MOS. And in mean field theory by Paul Blanc and others also about the time we wrote our paper in 2007. If you do a more detailed analysis, what you find is that in the TJ MOS state quite doesn't make it. It's actually quite competitive. The energy difference is usually in the fourth decimal place. And so my view is that small changes in the model actually can accommodate a state like that. But if you take a plain old TJ model, that's not what you find. Okay. So how does the state solve the puzzle? Well, if the order is perfect, Josephson coupling between the neighboring planes cancels exactly due to the system of a periodic array of pi textures. So essentially, the oscillatory character of the state guarantees that there is no Josephson coupling between the states, between the planes. So let's look at two planes, J1 and J2, between two and three layers apart, also cancelled by the same symmetry. The first non-vanishing coupling occurs at four layers, but that's, so in principle, that therefore there should be a TC which should be higher. But this is such a small coupling that essentially with the sample sizes that we have is unobservable. So that's the reason why the system behaves as if it were quasi two-dimensional. In principle, with this coupling alone, if the system is truly thermodynamic, as soon as the planes become ordered in this fashion, the whole thing should become ordered. But given the smallness of this coupling, this is not observable. Now, on the other hand, if you have defects, or discommensurations, which essentially are the same thing, they also give rise to some small Josephson coupling between nearby planes, and essentially this gives rise to the uniform superconducting state. So this is the actual state in this picture that competes with the uniform superconductivity. So are there other interactions? Well, what about couplings between different planes, so you can have terms, for instance, that will couple the superconducting order parameter in one plane with the next. But they typically come, if you want to do that, they involve the dot product of the spin orders, and since the spin order actually rotates from one place to one neighbor to the other, this actually tends to cancel. So in principle, a large enough magnetic field should align, essentially will produce a spin flop transition and should align the spin order states, and in principle that should actually enhance the superconducting order. And this effect has not yet been seen, although people haven't really looked for it. There is a strong suppression. In this state, they should expect a strong suppression of the three-dimensional superconducting state, but not of the 2D superconducting state. So what happens away from 1/8? Well, there is no perfect commensuration, and therefore you expect to see some effective coupling between the layers, Josephson coupling between the layers, which will rise quadratically away from that point in proportion to the number of these commensurations you have, and this is dictated by symmetry. So it should give you a deep minimum at that point. So similar effects should arise from disorder, and so on. So let me tell you a Landau-Ginzburg description of a state of this type. Well, let me look at the various orders that we have. Let me begin with the stripe superconductor. It's going to be a superconducting order parameter, which is oscillatory. So in addition to a possible uniform component that I will set to zero for the moment, you're going to have an oscillatory part, so it looks like a density wave in this case. So this is similar to what is usually called an FFLO type state, are actually an LO or Larkin or Chinnikov state, the FF state is a spiral, and Brakstein reversal, a state that is purely oscillatory, is what Larkin and Ovchinnikov had in mind. So it has a pairing amplitude with a wave vector Q, and that's a slowly varying piece of the order parameter, and there's another one with wave vector minus Q. In principle, if you could have a bidirectional state where you also have propagation along the perpendicular direction of the order. So in that case, we'll be more like a crystal in that particular picture, will not be a stripe. So let me consider for the moment only unidirectional states. What is important to keep in mind is that because this is a pair field, this is a complex field, and therefore these two amplitudes are not a complex conjugate of each other, contrary to what happens in a charge density wave. There is a nematic order parameter that describes the breaking of rotation symmetry, and is a real pseudoscalar order parameter. There's a charge stripe, rho k, which is essentially the amplitude of the charge density with wave vector k. And of course, rho minus k is the complex conjugate of rho k, since the charge density is real. And similarly, there is a spin stripe order parameter with wave vector q, which happens to be the same one as that. And as you will see in a moment, these two wave vectors have to be related by this relationship. K has to be equal to 2q, and this is what is seen in the experiment as well. You will see that there is a symmetry that forces that. So let me describe the Landau-Ginzburg free energy functional of this problem. It has the usual quadratic terms, which I will not bore you with. They just tell you that these orders are going to be present. I'm going to be interested in trilinear and quartic terms, which are rather interesting. So there are trilinear terms of this type that mix the charge density wave with the spin density wave order parameters. And translation invariance then requires k to be equal to 2q for this to be correct in the absence of this order. So there will be some coupling constant here. There is similarly a coupling between the charge density wave, in other words, the charge stripe, and this pair density wave order that I just described. Again, these are complex conjugates, so these are superconducting orders. In this way, this is gauge invariant. And to make this translation invariant, I need my rho k, provided k is also equal to 2q in this case. And in addition to that, there are couplings to the nematic order that will make the system anisotropic, and I will not discuss that for the moment. So what are the consequences? Well, one of them is this result, which is actually one of the interesting effects of the data, that the charge order and the spin order have a very precise relationship in their wave vectors. Normally, we would have thought that this could be independent. And in this case, they are locked together. And the same, so we propose that the same is true for the superconducting order. The stripe superconductor, well, it implies that there is this relationship between the periods and that there is also a nematic order. Now, so let me explain. What is also interesting, and this is actually something that I want to emphasize, is that if you have a superconducting order parameter that is modulated, and has an amplitude, say, delta q, and an amplitude delta minus q, you can make a translation invariant order parameter by multiplying these two order parameters, delta q and delta minus q. But that order parameter will be a composite order, which I will call delta 4, that will have charge 4e, as opposed to charge 2e, which is what these other orders have. So there should be at least a subdominant type of order which has essentially the wrong pairing. In other words, this actually looks like a condensate of four fermions. It's not a two fermion condensate. So there will be a state like that. So this is actually admissible essentially from the Landau analysis. So you expect to have that. So if these orders exist, you expect that order also to exist. Unless for some reason this coupling has to vanish. So the consequence of this is the existence of this pair density wave order implies existence of a uniform charge for a superconducting order in the system, which is also rather peculiar. So it's another consequence of this state. So what if I go below 4 Kelvin and I have a coexisting a uniform superconducting state with this triad order parameter. Well, now I'm going to have an additional order parameter, let me call it delta naught, coexisting with this. I will now have other types of terms that mix these order parameters. For instance, there is this term that will mix the uniform D-wave order parameter with the pair density wave and the Q component of the charge order. So the prediction then is that if you have a phase transition where the uniform component of the order of the superconducting order parameter is non-zero, there should be a change in the character of the charge order that is seen, and in particular a peak at the same ordering wave vector should appear in the charge order, therefore violating the k equals 2q rule. All right, so this is actually this is something that my colleague Peter Abamonte is searching for at the moment using X-rays. There is some evidence from the Toronto group that actually at low temperatures, the k equals 2q peak appears to be somewhat suppressed, but there is no evidence. That group has not looked at k equals q, and so that hasn't been done yet experimentally. So a small uniform component delta naught removes, in particular, the sensitivity to quench this order of the pair density wave state because essentially dominates over everything. One thing I will not show you is that if you do a Bogoliubov-Lejeune calculation of the spectrum, once you have some sort of striped order, even though it's superconducting, you don't get nodes. What you get is essentially pockets of essentially Bogoliubov quasi-particles. But as soon as the uniform component delta naught kicks in, all of that gets suppressed and you recover the nodal behavior. So let me talk about the topological excitations of a striped superconductor, which are rather interesting. And they are different from the things you're used to. So as far as the charge order is concerned, this is the charge density wave order parameter. So let me assume that I am deep in the phase where the charge order is present. So I'm going to freeze the amplitude to be some constant, and there will be the wave vector here, and this will be the phase or the phason of the charge density wave. I can do the same analysis for the PDW, for the pair density wave state. I'm going to assume that these amplitudes are going to be equal to each other in magnitude, and that's required by parity. But the phases don't have to be equal, so I'm going to freeze the amplitudes to be the same, but I have two phases, and the reason is because this is a theory with two complex order parameters as opposed to one, which is the conventional situation in the uniform superconductor. So this state has actually a bigger order parameter space than the conventional superconductor. So in particular, we're going to have two phase fields. And if you look at the term, one of my trilinear terms, particularly that mixes these two order parameters here, what you see is that there is a term that tends to lock in the relative phase of these two guys with the phase field of the charge density wave. So there is a cosine term of this type, and it tends to lock in the relative phase. So this is so I can take my two phases and think in terms of an average phase and a relative phase, as it is here, and the relative phase is just locked to that. Now, these two phases, being phases, are single-valued modulo 2 pi. Therefore, the individual phases theta plus and theta minus are defined modulo pi. So, and now I know that phi and theta minus are locked, so what I'm going to get are the topological defects of my charge density wave, or if you want the charge stripe in this case, and the topological defects of theta plus, which is like the average of these two phases. I'm going to neglect in this part of the analysis the spin stripe since essentially it does the same thing. But there are more possible topological excitations in that case. So let me first discuss a superconducting vortex. Essentially, it's a vortex in the theta plus phase, which is the average phase of the two components of my order parameter, where that phase winds by 2 pi. But essentially, the charge order is essentially insensitive to that. It doesn't have any texture. So this is a conventional vortex. There is a possibility of having a dislocation in the charge order, which essentially will make phi jump by 2 pi, and that is consistent with theta plus jumping by pi. So in other words, it corresponds to a half vortex. I'll show you a picture now what that means. So in other words, there is a half vortex of the superconducting order coupled with the single dislocation of the, yes. And then finally, there is a double dislocation of the charge order that doesn't see the superconducting order. Now, if you do the usual sort of analysis, all three types of order have logarithmic interactions, so you can do Costa Stavlis times 3, so to speak. There are 3 different pathways for melting this state. Okay, so this is a picture of the half vortex with the dislocation. So here you have the order parameter change in sign. In other words, the phase goes from 0 to pi to 0 to pi to 0 to pi. But if you have a dislocation, there is a phase mismatch of pi sitting here, which is supplied by the order parameter. So that's my half vortex. On the other hand, if I have a double dislocation, it doesn't see it. It's perfectly insensitive to that. Okay. So let me look at the thermal melting of this state. There are 3 paths to do that. I have 3 types of topological excitations. This is what will be the topological charge of the vortex. For the superconductor will be 1, 0. 0, 1 will be the double dislocation in this notation. And I can have 1 half and 1 half with different possible relative signs. So this corresponds to the single dislocation and the half vortex. The scaling dimensions can be computed in the usual way in doing Gaussian fluctuations, in the way you do that for Costa-Stavlis theory. And the phase boundary, at least naively, is a place where the scaling dimensions of this type of excitations is equal to 2, because you're in 2 dimensions and they have to be marginal. So that depends on 2 parameters. There is a superconducting superfluid density and the CW stiffness that this state has. Okay, there are 2 parameters that enter and the temperature. So you expect the following phases. The pair density wave phase, you expect a uniform charge for each superconductor. You'll see in a moment how it arises. A charge density wave or stripe, and the normal phase that here, because of the breaking of rotational symmetry, is actually an ionizing pneumatic. So here is a phase diagram that you can deduce from these arguments. So let me scale the temperature by the superfluid density of the superconductor, rho s, and the stiffness of the CW also by the superfluid density, rho s. So you can be here, probably in this picture, LBCO is somewhere here, because you go from some kind of isotropic state, presumably becomes a pneumatic at some point, and then it goes into the stripe state, and it becomes a superconductor at lower temperatures. Now, you could come and melt the system directly by essentially proliferating the half vortices coupled to single dislocations, and that will take you straight into this state. And, or you can actually melt by proliferating the double dislocations that doesn't affect the superconductivity, but what leaves behind is a uniform charge for a superconductor. So there are various consequences that follow from just this simple analysis. One of them is that there is a potential for the violation of the usual quantization, the charge quantization that we assume superconductors have in this state. Before I do that, let me finish with some effects of this order. The system will become glassy, yes. Because you're breaking translation symmetry and rotational invariance, so you expect the system to become a glass. And in particular, if this order essentially pins these half vortices, this will look like a gauge glass because there will be these flux pi objects which are randomly distributed in the material. So this potentially can explain why the resistive transition happens before the Meissner state. So in fact, glassy behaviors, in fact, the memory effect is seen in the Kerr effect beginning at about 35 Kelvin or so. So let me now, since I'm running out of time, let me tell you about interesting phase-sensitive experiments that one can do. So you can imagine having either a junction of a striped superconductor of this type with a uniform charge to a superconductor. This should lead to a fractionalization, essentially, of the Shapiro steps, or if you wish, of the Josephson effect. Instead of being cosine of the difference of the phase, will be cosine of twice the difference of the phase, as if it was HC over 4E in the charge flux. So similarly, you can do that in a loop real geometry. You can have here a charge for a superconductor, say this object here, completing a Josephson loop of this type. So let me tell you something about, do we have a minute? Okay. One of the things that I assumed in this analysis is that the rotational order is frozen in, that the stripe, that the coupling to the lattice is overwhelming, and therefore the system is always locked to a particular direction on that lattice. What if I tune that? And presumably this is in somewhere in theory space, but it's hard to achieve in LBCO. Presumably by changing some properties of the material, one could achieve this, but for the moment, let me indulge in this to understand what's going on. So there are various things that can happen. So let me tell you the bottom line of this. If there was no coupling to the lattice, then the system will have full rotational symmetry, and all of these phases that break translation symmetry in two dimensions will disappear by an old argument by Toner and Nelson, essentially in the physics of liquid crystals, which are essentially have the same type of symmetry. So you would expect, essentially, the charge 4E superconductor, the only one that will survive of all of these phases in that case, okay? Except possibly from a nematic state. That's the other. So in a sense, that state is actually the nematic state. On the other hand, if the pinning to the lattice is intermediate, then various phases will be suppressed and others will be enhanced. So as a function of that, you can draw. So this sort of the phase diagram I just showed you is essentially this picture. And the other extreme limit is you have a nematic superconductor with a PDW existing only at zero temperature by this type of argument. You could have a conventional uniform superconductor and fully isotropic. That's also possible depending on this ratio of kappa over rho s. And there will be some essentially multicritical points sitting here. In between, you could essentially alter the range over which these temperatures, these phases may occur. And in fact, as you weaken the coupling to the lattice, this charge for a superconductor, which here is christened a nematic superconductor, is actually enhanced. It has a number of interesting properties that I can tell you afterwards. Okay.
Maybe we have time for questions?
Yes. Yes.
Phases can be heuristically understood using valence bond order.
Using what?
Using valence bond order, singlet bond order.
Yes, it's possible. I agree.
So
you notice that I gave a purely phenomenological talk without reference to microscopic mechanisms. Right.
So I'm trying to understand your 4E superconducting state.
Yes.
In terms of valence bond order. Is it related to this Plaquette delocalization? Because in your picture,
It's a quartet. Essentially, it's a condensate of it's a four fermion condensate.
So that means, in terms of valence bond order, it would be like a Plaquette which is delocalized.
Right. So it's a state where essentially the, if you wish, the valence bonds themselves will be fluctuating, but the product isn't. So in a sense, so this already gives you a hint that this cannot be done in a weak coupling phase. So by the way, I didn't mention for a reason. I didn't mention mechanisms. It's extremely hard to obtain a state like the pair density wave state in BCS. You need a couple, if you do a BCS analysis because you don't have nesting, you need a coupling constant of order one, and many things can happen. So the weak coupling analysis is unreliable in that limit.
But within slave boson and RVB.
You could. And so in that sense, there is no, in my view, there is no difference. These are, if you wish, these are anisotropic versions of RVV, if you wish, in the sense that there is a large local pairing scale associated with all of these states. In that sense, they have the same common, how to say, physics.
Other questions?
So this charge 4E is for conducting
yes.
all the parameter. The Josephson coupling, interlayer Josephson coupling of
speak
that.
Speak up.
So interlayer Josephson coupling between yes. charge 4E.
Yes.
For the
we'll have this character that I just noted, in fact.
That's not.
Will look like this.
Yeah, that's not suppressed by.
Because it looks like tunneling of, not of pairs, but of pairs of pairs.
Yeah, pairs of pairs.
Right.
So question is there any corners in the phase diagram where you have charge 4E condensate without charge 2E condensate?
Yes, this is the, where it is here. This is this corner.
Oh, that's without charge 2E condensate.
Right.
Okay.
And the reason why there is no charge, okay, first of all, this is a non-uniform state. As soon as you have a what I call delta naught, which is the conventional charge 2E condensate, that takes over and essentially what happens is that these four fermion bound states, if you want to use that terminology, become unstable to two fermion bound states, to conventional pairing. So that's the usual argument for why you don't get quartet condensate. Because if one is present, the other states become unstable. So here, because it's possible, because if you have a condensate, a pair condensate with a finite wave vector, but not with zero wave vector, then that instability is forbidden.
Other questions?
So you made a comment about the gauge glass picture that would emerge because of the disorder.
Yes.
So, but you didn't. There's no relationship between this and the behavior of the resistivity that was shown for the in-plane transport, right?
Say it again.
You showed some data for the in-plane yes. resistivity and the scaling, which you said right. was KT-like, right?
So it's KT-like within the data that is available at the moment. It's not of the same. I mean, I'm not going to put my hands on fire to say they have seen really KT behavior. It's consistent with that within the quality of the current data.
So. But this gauge glass the gauge glass transport that would arise in your phase diagram, there's no evidence of that.
The only evidence for that is the fact that the two transitions don't coincide, and there is a memory effect. In other words, I see essentially a form of hysteresis that appears to onset at about 35 Kelvin. So that suggests that the order is actually glassy in character.
But then the transport should have also a different type
yes, of... Yes, it should. I know.
That hasn't been seen, right?
Well, as I said, you mean what you expect to see is a hysteresis in transport. Is that that's what you're asking for? Is some form of glassy behavior in transport? And this hasn't been seen yet. But I don't think.
No, I'm talking about the nonlinear transport that would exist below the reversibility.
Yes. Yeah, it should look like a gauge glass, essentially, for this to be consistent. But as I said, the memory effect that is seen in the Kerr effect experiments is suggestive that this actually is consistent with that. Otherwise, it's very hard to understand why the C-axis resistivity doesn't vanish at the same place where the Meissner state appears in this case.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Eduardo again then.